From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, even the most successful musicians often don't own their recordings. Taylor Swift is in a spat with a man who just bought her early albums. Then there's an upcoming spinoff from the hit series Black-ish. It's called Mixed-ish, and the show's producer says it's a comedy about a mixed-race girl growing up in the 1980s.
But at the same time, we want to put some of these conversations about race and both sides of the coin on the table and really look at it.
And we're going to visit the headquarters of some do-it-yourself video game designers. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. If you were wondering over the weekend about the origins of the Twitter hashtag #WeStandWithTaylor, well, we have some answers for you. It begins with the $300 million sale of Taylor Swift's former record label, Big Machine. Swift is unhappy with the new owner of her first six albums, music manager Scooter Braun. Swift took to Tumblr yesterday to voice her disappointment with the deal, calling it my worst-case scenario. Washington Post reporter Emily Yar has been following the story, and when we spoke today, she gave us some background on Scooter Braun.
If you've ever heard his name, you probably know him because he's the guy who discovered Justin Bieber on YouTube many years ago and made him extremely famous. And in the years since, he, you know, has represented everyone from Ariana Grande to Demi Lovato to Kanye West to Carly Rae Jepsen. And I think one interesting thing about him is you usually don't really hear much about, you know, music managers, but he is always very much in the spotlight. He has a huge following on Instagram and Twitter. So he kind of likes to be right alongside the very famous people he represents.
So Scooter Braun is an early champion of Justin Bieber. And on the other side of this deal is a guy named Scott Borchetta, who is a very early supporter of Taylor Swift. And now Scooter Braun is buying Scott Borchetta's record label, right? Which is Big Machine Label Group?
Yes, that's correct. So Scott Borchetta, he's kind of famous in the Taylor Swift origin story because he met her in Nashville when she was about 14 or 15, and he didn't actually even have a label at the time. He worked at Universal, but he was planning to start his own. But he basically went up to Taylor and said, you know, I believe in you. I would love if you would wait for me and, you know, sign with my record label. So she actually chose him over a lot of other established labels at the time, again, before the label even had a name. And then clearly things worked out really well, and she put Big Machine on the map.
The other thing that has worked out maybe not as well is it feels as if Taylor Swift and Scott Borchetta have had some sort of falling out, because Taylor Swift has been very vocal on social media, which is not something she typically does, about her displeasure with this deal. She said that the sale had stripped her of her life's work. What are her complaints about this sale, and what is the nature of her dispute with Scott and Scooter?
So right around the time last year when her deal was expiring with Big Machine, it was kind of being reported that the main sticking point and why she might leave was over her masters, because she wanted to have ownership of all of her master recordings from her first six albums. But negotiations kind of fell apart, so she ended up walking away from Big Machine and going to Universal. And now she's saying that she is really upset, and or actually her specific words were she was grossed out that Scooter Braun bought Big Machine and now owns her masters, because she said that he has been bullying her for years and Scott Borchetta knew about this, yet he, you know, sold the company to Scooter Braun anyway.
And it does sound like they did make some sort of offer for Taylor Swift to get her masters back, but part of the deal was that for every album she got back from Big Machine, she had to give them a new one, which really isn't much of a deal as far as Taylor Swift is concerned. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's what Taylor said in her post was, yeah, in negotiations, the deal was that she would, right, earn one album back at a time based on her putting out new albums on Big Machine and staying with them. And yeah, Scott Borchetta, in his response back, he, you know, said that she could have owned her master recordings and then chose to leave. He didn't really go into too much detail, but presumably instead of staying and releasing an album and earning them back, she decided to leave the label.
So even if Taylor Swift will not be making new records for Big Machine, they have her catalog of some past albums, and they also have a couple of prominent artists. So Does Big Machine now make money off of the catalog sales from Taylor Swift? And what other artists do they have that actually might be worth this $300 million deal?
Yeah, they will still definitely make money from Taylor's songs, and she made up a huge amount of their revenue. But they already have a lot of success with country artists. They have Florida Georgia Line, who's one of the biggest acts in country music. They recently signed Lady Antebellum. They have Rascal Flatts, Reba McEntire. So they have some pretty big country superstars, and it kind of makes sense why Scooter Braun, who already sort of works with some country music artists like Zach Brown Band and Dan and Shay, why he would want to expand to Nashville.
And it feels like there are two stories here. One is the deal, and the other story is kind of the social media reaction to the deal. How big is this rift, and what is behind it?
Yeah, it really blew up on social media on Sunday, very shortly after Taylor wrote her Tumblr post. The hashtag #WeStandWithTaylor was like already trending worldwide on Twitter. Her fans really jumped on this. And then it just continued to pick up steam as Justin Bieber wrote this really long Instagram post. You don't, again, usually see captions like this from him either, where he defended Scooter and, you know, kind of turned it around and said, actually, like, Taylor is acting like the bully now because she wrote this takedown ensuring that, you know, her fans would go after Scooter. And then it blew up even more when people like Halsey and Iggy Azalea and Martha Hunt and Cara Delevingne all criticized Justin Bieber and all the hate that Taylor was getting. And then Demi Lovato stepped in to defend Scooter Braun. So it's just been this back and forth between people with, you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of Instagram followers. And it shows no sign of slowing down.
But Taylor Swift going forward has an incredibly lucrative deal with Republic Records, a label that's owned by the Universal Music Group. Does that factor into the story at all? Is Taylor Swift now completely independent, or is it possible that Scooter Braun and Taylor Swift and Scott Borchetta's paths might somehow cross in the future?
I don't know. I'm so curious about what is going on behind the scenes today as this is all playing out so publicly, because I know there were some rumors or people maybe thought that, you know, Universal would try to buy Big Machine. And Scooter buying it was definitely a surprise. So I would not be shocked if this wasn't the last we heard from all of them. But yeah, I will be very intrigued to see how it plays out.
Emily Yar is a Washington Post style reporter who covers pop culture and entertainment. Emily, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, our series of conversations with prominent TV producers continues with Karen Gist. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and this summer we're talking with a number of prominent writer-producers about the state of the TV industry. They're known as showrunners, and they have to balance the creative side with the business side of making TV, so their perspective is maybe the best barometer of where the business is and where it's going. Today my guest is Karen Gist. She's the showrunner of the upcoming ABC comedy Mixed-ish. It's a spinoff from Black-ish. The new series tells the childhood story of Tracee Ellis Ross's character, Rainbow Johnson, when she was growing up in a mixed-race family in the 1980s. Gist worked on Grey's Anatomy and the Lee Daniels series Star, but before she broke into TV, she was an unhappy lawyer.
I spent a lot of time daydreaming. That's what I did all day. I was bored. It wasn't like feeding me at all. And I started taking some classes at this place called Writer's Boot Camp in Santa Monica just to have an outlet. And I started writing, and then I got turned to TV. And I started tracking down people that worked in TV and getting tickets to tapings. And a friend of mine got a ticket to the taping of Girlfriends, which was a show on the CW. Or at the time UPN, and then it went to the CW, but she got tickets, and she invited me, and then that was a game changer for me.
So what did you see in that taping that really changed your whole outlook on what you wanted to do?
It was, first of all, seeing women who looked like me and who were experiencing life in the way that I was at the time right there. And then also, so it was the storytelling. That's what I fell in love with. But also the process, it just seemed exciting and alive. There was more of a charge to me just watching them do it. And the taping went to like midnight, I think.
So how do you get in the door?
That day when I was, when the taping was over and we were filing out of the soundstage, I stopped at the door of the soundstage and I said, turn around and go introduce yourself to someone. And so I got the attention of the stand up that warmed up the audience, and he leaned over the rail and got the attention of a writer on the show, Bernadette Luckett, who is my godmother in this business because she gave me access, really. And I told her a little bit about myself. I don't remember exactly what I said, but she wrote her number on the corner of her script and she tore it off. And I took that number and I went back to the firm, and tucked it in, I'm going to give my age away, into the Rolodex. and I just kept it there. And I started writing A Will and Grace, and that was my first spec. So at the time, I just watched Will and Grace over and over and studied it and the rhythms of it, and then wrote my first spec and called Bernadette up when it was done, and I thought it was in good shape or good enough shape. I didn't know. And I said, you know, I don't know if you remember me, but you gave me your number and I have the script. And she did. She
remembered. How many months later was it?
I would say 7-8 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And she remembered and she gave me notes on the script and I turned it around and she thought it was in good enough shape to show Mara Brockekiel. She's the creator of the show. Right. And so she read my script and I got an interview for this writer's trainee program. At the time, the Guild had a program where if you could find a show that would be a part of the program, they would pay half and the studio would pay half up to 20 weeks.
Was this part of a diversity program?
Yeah, it was a diversity program that Mara had come up through as well. So I think I was a trainee for about 9 weeks. And then she asked me into her office and said, I'm going to give you a script and I'm going to staff you. And I think I may have cursed. Get the fuck out of here.
Cursed and happiness, I hope.
I was so happy. I was so happy that she gave me a shot. And then I've just been blessed and working.
Wow. We're talking with Karen Gist. She's a TV writer and producer and the showrunner of the upcoming series Mixed-ish. We know what Black-ish is. Mm-hmm. We know what Grown-ish is. What's your pitch for Mixed-ish? This is Rainbow Johnson's origin story?
It is, yes. It is Rainbow Johnson, and Tracy will do the voiceover. So it's, you know, the adult Rainbow is looking back and thinking about all these things that help shape her.
And when we got to school, we got introduced to the real world.
I'm too little to die!
Real quick.
What are you weirdos mixed with?
What's mixed?
My parents had sent us out into the world with absolutely no warning that being mixed was even a thing.
Imagine being the new kid when no one in the world is like you. But you have to understand.
Today's mixed kids can look up to rappers, ballerinas, athletes, a president, and a princess. The only heroes we had were DeBarge.
Our intention with Mixed-ish is to have a balanced conversation about some of the issues in this country. And we have the ability to talk about what's going on now, but back in the 80s, so that we can kind of comment on today's issues and see the beginning, the seeds of it back then. But we really want to just focus on, you know, this awkward 12-year-old girl who's trying to fit in. It's a little bit of Wonder Years. There's a little bit of a gooey heart center to the show. But at the same time, we want to put some of these conversations about race and both sides of the coin on the table and really look at it in a way that hopefully will make people have the conversation outside of the show.
I want to ask you about the lessons that you have learned, less about writing, but about collaboration, because you have worked with some really interesting people. I'm wondering, what are the lessons that you have taken away from some of your collaborators, less about like how to structure a plot and how to tell a story versus how to work with other writers and be collaborative, but also make sure that the vision of what it is you're trying to do isn't diluted by all the other voices around you?
The biggest lesson I've learned, and this is a lesson in life too, like never lead with ego, like take ego out of everything. And once you do that, I think it's easier to collaborate and hear everyone. And one of the first lessons I learned in a room was on Girlfriends. if a pitch isn't taken, it doesn't mean the pitch is bad. It just means the pitch isn't good for what we're doing right now. And I think a lot of writers can get really, writers are sensitive beings who love lunch. That's what we do. But, you know, this idea that something wasn't taken in a room can be silencing in a way and remove a writer from the conversation. And when you really think about what that is, that's just a bruised ego. And so across the board, from a staff writer to a showrunner to a creator, I think everyone has to come to the table wanting to lift the project up. And, you know, the best thing to me in a room is the alley-oop. I think you lift an idea up and you hope somebody else can slam dunk it or just move it along a little bit. And then if it eventually is a clunker, it falls and that's fine. But I think what I've learned from working with some of the heavier hitters in the business is it's about the work, about the project. And, you know, what Lee used to say all the time, you protect the baby.
If you looked at a photo gallery of network TV writers' rooms and even network TV casts from 10 years ago to today, you would see a fundamental difference in a lot more women and people of color, both behind the scenes and on screen. Still not enough, but certainly an improvement. You've been there for some of that.
I don't know. It depends.
You think it's been fractional. How would you assess where we've come and how far we still have to go?
I think we have a long way to go. Yes, there are more television shows that are focused on people of color. And so then we have, you know, a lot of writers' rooms where we have writers of color or diverse writers in those rooms especially. But I don't think that the more traditional shows actually have really diverse rooms. And that's because the ability to pull someone up is, you don't have that ability if there isn't someone at the top to do it. And I think we have a long way to go in terms of getting more women and people of color across the board in positions of power to then reach back and pull up.
We need more Shondas. We need more Kenyas. We need more Lees.
We need more co-EPs, more we need more story editors and producers, people who continue to come up through the ranks so that they can become the Shondas or the Kenyas.
You talked about being in that taping of Girlfriends and seeing people who are acting who look like you and whose stories were not unfamiliar to your own story. And it feels like if you look at some of your credits, Girlfriends, Grey's Anatomy, Star, Mixed-ish, that there are a lot of very strong, independent women at the centers of the shows that you are working on. And I suspect that's not random.
That is not random. I tend to be drawn to, I'm drawn to stories about others, people who feel a little marginalized. I love a strong woman who has some big decision to make or somebody who's trying to figure it out, because that's who I am all the time. No matter how successful I am, I'm always just trying to navigate and figure out who I am and where I fit in and what I'm supposed to say and what my purposes. And so for me, having a character who is constantly questioning and growing and giving and writing that from the point of view of a strong woman is just something that I seek out and I'm drawn to.
Karen Gist, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you want to hear our earlier interview with showrunner Alan Yang, whose credits include Master of None, go to theframe.org. Coming up after a short break, not all popular video games are made by big budget companies. We'll visit a do-it-yourself collective for game designers. Video games are a multi-billion dollar industry, raking in more than Hollywood, the music industry, and streaming services. But it's not all blockbusters like Red Dead Redemption 2 and Call of Duty. Some indie do-it-yourself developers are quietly making some memorably quirky games in the shadow of the major studios. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited a collective of game designers in Culver City and has this report.
This is a video game called Dream Daddy. It's a dad dating simulator. Not exactly a conventional commercial video game, but that's the spirit at Glitch City, a collective of indie game artists and developers co-founded by Ben Esposito.
No one's making money from this. Like, this is just people trying to help other people make interesting art. And so I think If you're cool with the DIY, if you're cool with the empty weird warehouse, then you belong here.
It is a pretty empty warehouse, a small industrial space off Robertson Boulevard in Culver City that kind of feels like garage meets dorm room, complete with a string of Christmas lights draped overhead. Esposito started Glitch City in 2013, along with another Ben Vance.
At times we've described ourselves as kind of an art collective, a game collective, something in between, and we're not just trying to clone other games or like make games at any cost. You know, we're all trying to challenge it, the medium, in a different way, or to kind of take a different approach. And there is a DIY, kind of a little bit of a punk aesthetic.
Another founding member was Eric, who preferred not to give his last name.
I was just working at coffee shops a lot, and that was like my main way of like staying sane and keeping on task. But, you know, you don't have to work at a coffee shop alone. So it really just took me asking both the Bens to basically, let's just work at a coffee shop. And eventually that got called Strawberry Jam, which became kind of a precursor to Glitch City.
Today, Glitch City has a fluid group of about 24 citizens. But this isn't a video game company. Everyone here is making their own games, and many of them make their living as contract artists for other clients, like Rachel Sala.
People are like, hey, I need a logo, or I need some animation, or I need someone to skin this mini game for me. That's how I get most of my work.
Sala made the coffee today.
Make it basically every day. It's not good. You can drink it, though. It does the job.
Part of the benefit of Glitch City is that like doing your own project is very hard.
Brendan Chung used to work for a major game studio. Now he runs his own indie company out of Glitch City.
I have holes in my knowledge, and I could like look to my right and say, hey, take a look at this. What would you think about this? Everyone just kind of like understands where every project is, and we all can kind of like chip in and kind of give feedback on how everyone else is doing. There's something kind of magical there.
People aren't just developing games here. Candy Emberly is a composer.
So yeah, I'm writing music for a battle right now. We have all these different kinds of monsters, and you can have what's essentially a boss fight with any of them, and the hope is that it will all be recorded live at the end. That's a funding question.
Rather than corporate meetings, Glitch City does family dinners, as Eric explains.
It's a meeting, but more informal than a group meeting. Because if it was a true meeting, it'd just be chaos having, you know, like 20 people try to do some input towards that.
Eric's also being modest.
Here's Ben Vance again.
Because there's usually a giant dinner that's prepared, and it's often him or Rachel that are taking care of that. So there's a bunch of food and a bunch of sharing of what's going on in the space.
The games coming out of Glitch City are as diverse and quirky as its residents. Ben Esposito made a game called Donut County.
It's a game where you play as a hole in the ground, and you start really small, and you move it under stuff to make it fall in, and every time you eat something, it gets a little bit bigger. And so it's a game about kind of like scale and destruction and like what happens to a place over time as you like start to erase the things from it.
Eric's currently working on a game called Oft Horizon,
which is a seafaring exploration game. I've been working on it for many, many years, but not continuously and not full time. But it's about exploring a world that changes over time.
Last year, Brendan Chung released Quadrilateral Cowboy.
It's a far cry from the days of file cabinets and phone books.
You play as one of three ladies who are starting a startup company where companies hire you to hack other companies. So you're like guns for hire, basically. But instead of guns, you have computers. And it's set in this alternate 1980s universe, and everything's very clunky, everything's very analog.
Ben Vance is in the midst of developing a virtual reality experience called Irrational Exuberance,
which is a deep space exploration. It's kind of like an experiment in ripping you out of, you know, your current reality and just throwing you out into deep space as yourself, and trying to make that sort of tangible.
And the first game Rachel Sala ever put out was called Frog Fractions.
Which is a comedy game, has nothing to do with math. You won't learn anything if you play it. And it's about the joy of discovery and the spirit of exploration. So you do literally play as a frog, but you go into space, become president of Bug Mars, and silly things happen overall.
These are clearly all slightly idiosyncratic labors of love. I asked Rachel Sala, is this an exciting time to be an indie game developer? Or a scary one?
It's scary because there's a lot riding on it. there's always pressure to perform well and do well. And I think a lot of us here at this point are pretty far along in our careers, and we want to keep making successful games. And there's a lot of creativity out there. There's a lot of wild ideas. Almost every day there's some game that comes out. I'm like, oh, I wish I thought of that.
But Ben Vance says being a citizen of Glitch City means you don't have to truck it alone.
It's really hard making creative work. Especially in a vacuum when you don't have anything to bounce your ideas off of. You know, staying motivated is one of the biggest things, and having a space for that and people to, you know, connect with, talk to, and just even just like commiserate with, you know. What problems are you dealing with? Oh, yeah, that one.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's the show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow.